Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do you keep in your freezer? Even in this era when conscientious cooks seek out fresh ingredients whenever possible, a bag of frozen peas or a block of frozen spinach can come in very handy in a pinch. But less than a century ago, these conveniences were seen as nothing short of magical by people who had previously been limited to eating only what could be consumed or preserved within a few days after harvest. As author Mark Kurlansky demonstrates in his new book, we owe much of this taken-for-granted technology to one American with an insatiable appetite for adventure, for knowledge, and for exotic cuisine. The book is called Bird's Eye, The Adventures of a Curious Man. Mark, welcome to Think.
Hi.
So Clarence Birdseye had made cameos in two or three of your previous books. How did you decide it was time to devote an entire one to him?
Yeah, that's right. He just kept turning up. This is in my cod book because of his tremendous impact on the fish business, and in my salt book because he just about ruined the salt business, and in a book called The Last Fish Tale about Gloucester, Massachusetts, where he worked for many years. And nobody's ever written a biography on him. He had an enormous impact on our lives. And I just thought it was time that somebody did. Plus, he's just, I mean, what I always look for in a book is a good story, and he's just a great story.
You describe him as a sort of foodie in reverse. He dreamed of industrialization in the same way we dream of eliminating it. And yet, we've benefited in significant ways from the efficient production and distribution of food.
Yeah, he was born in 1886, the height of the Industrial Revolution. Cars, electric lights, phonographs had all been invented just before he was born, and as he was growing up, a few life-changing things a year appeared. A time kind of like today, only it was mechanical things from industry. And just like people growing up today will probably tend to have this idea that computer electronics are the great answer to everything. People who grew up in his time thought that industry was the magical solution to everything.
Starting from the time he was a kid, we have glimpses of the entrepreneurial spirit in him and his curiosity. So he's 10 and he wants a shotgun, and he develops a market for something that nobody else recognized any value in.
Yeah, he really wanted a shotgun. Another characteristic of his time, he grew up in New York. He was born in Brooklyn. And the most famous New Yorker, oddly enough, was William Cody, Buffalo Bill Cody. Mm-hmm. Some historians say the most famous person in the world. And he grew up with this image of people who shot a lot of things. Buffalo Bill Cody was famous for shooting 4,200 and something buffalo in one season. Birdseye, who read lots of romantic Western adventures, he wanted to shoot things too, and he really wanted a shotgun. And in that way that kids obsess about something they really want, he came up with this idea on his family's farm. There were a lot of muskrats. When I was 10 years old, I would have never thought to call the Bronx Zoo about this, but he did, and asked them if they wanted some muskrats, and they said they didn't, but they hooked him up with a British guy who was stocking an estate and wanted the muskrats, probably because they ate something that he was trying to get rid of. And so he started shipping live muskrats to England and raised enough money to get his shotgun. And then he started hanging out at taxidermy stores and reading books and learning how to stuff all these birds he was shooting, and created, at the age of 11, what he called the American School of Taxidermy, which he advertised in magazines. And I couldn't find any record if he got any response to this, but I can imagine what somebody would have thought when they discovered that the American School of Taxidermy was one 11-year-old boy.
Yeah, all the courses written out in longhand on notebook paper.
Right.
So you mentioned he grew up in part on a farm. In fact, though, he was descended from Puritan stock, born into a family of means, but they seem to have suffered a sort of reversal of fortune when he was a young man.
Yeah. He came from a family of lawyers. His great-grandfather had been a U.S. representative. His grandfather, when he died, the New York Times obituary called him the most prominent lawyer in New York, which, you know, I mean, lawyers are the main thing New York produces, so that's pretty good. And his father was a well-known lawyer who had written books on New York statutory law that were studied by law students. And Birdseye went to Amherst, as did his father and his uncles, and it was kind of the family place. And 2 years into his study, the family ran out of money. And although I really tried, I could not find out exactly why. But I did find desperate letters in Amherst in their archives. There were letters from him saying, can I please have a scholarship or I'm going to have to drop out of school? And he didn't get the scholarship, and he dropped out after 2 years.
And he had finally been sort of finding his stride as a student of biology at that point.
Yes, I actually looked at his report card. And yeah, by far and away, his best subject was science, and he took advanced courses in biology and was really focusing that well. Did not do well in gym.
And did not do well in Spanish, which would come to probably be something he regretted far later in his life.
That's right. Years later, towards the end of his life, when he was living in Peru, he probably remembered all those Spanish courses at Amherst that he could barely get through.
And we should say Birdseye was his real name, and it's hard to imagine how different the company might have fared if it had been, you know, Boyd Frozen Foods or Kurlansky Frozen Foods.
Oh, I think Kurlansky Frozen Foods would be just fine.
It would be fine. Maybe it's just Boyd that wouldn't work. But Birdseye was just an ideal name.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of an odd name. You always like to tell this story about how he was in San Francisco, and he was short on money and wanted to cash a check, and so he called up the Birdseye Company and asked if they could cash a check for him. And he said, I'm Clarence Birdseye. And the guy on the other end said, well, sir, if you tell me your real name, I'll try to help you. Nobody believed that there really was somebody named Birdseye. Even today, I mean, when I go and tell people that I've written a biography of Clarence Birdseye, they say, Birdseye as in frozen? Because everybody's heard of the brand name, but
yeah,
Nobody realizes it was actually a person.
And we all know him as Clarence, but in fact, everybody called him Bob beginning in his adult life.
Yes, he never went by Clarence. And he was, by all accounts, a great salesman. And, you know, Bob is probably a better salesman name than Clarence.
Yeah, you can sort of imagine him thrusting his hand out and saying, pleased to meet you, Bob Birdseye.
Right, exactly.
All right, so let's talk about how he left the greater New York area. He ends up with the U.S. Biological Survey, and his job, although he's called a naturalist, his job doesn't strike us today as sounding very familiar.
Well, this is what a naturalist in the U.S. Biological Survey did. They went around and asked ranchers and farmers what kind of animals they didn't like, and then they killed them for them. And they, you know, they wiped out in the West. They wiped out wolves and coyotes and cougars and gophers and all kinds of things. Ironically, later it was turned into U.S. Fish and Wildlife, which then focused on bringing back endangered species, which were the very species that they had wiped out as the U.S. Biological Survey. So Birdseye was in the wiping out stage, and he was in the Arizona and New Mexico territory before there were states and before there were roads, and he was traveling around on horseback, shooting and trapping animals.
And he realized that there was no sense in letting them go to waste. For one thing, he would eat a lot of what he shot.
But yeah, then I mean, this was the thing about Birdseye, is that when he saw an animal that he hadn't seen before, his first thought was, I wonder what this would taste like. And you know, he had this urge to shoot and eat everything. Mm-hmm. Later, it became more sophisticated. It was shoot, freeze, and eat.
Yeah. But again, he realized there was a market for the pelts that were otherwise just going to waste.
Yeah, he always looked for a profit in things. And he found people in New York who bought coyote pelts, which most people wouldn't even realize there was a market for. And he made money on the side that way.
Later, he worked on a team investigating Rocky Mountain spotted fever. And it's interesting that this, of the jobs that he did out of the country or out of his home territory of the U.S., this was maybe one of the most dangerous things he took on.
Yeah, it was very dangerous. The reason that the U.S. government was investigating Rocky Mountain spotted fever was that in this particular valley, the Bitterroot in Montana, large numbers of people were dying from this. And it was strange because it was a disease that showed up in other places without being that fatal. But there, it was a very fatal disease. And the U.S. government went into U.S. agencies and asked for volunteers to go to the Bitterroot and work on this project investigating Rocky Mountain spotted fever. So one of the places they asked was at the U.S. Biological Survey, and only one hand went up. The theory, which proved to be true, was that it was spread by ticks. And so his job was to go and collect ticks. So this was very dangerous, because if you got bitten by a tick, you could die. And it was very important research, which led not only to controlling Rocky Mountain spotted fever, but later during World War II to controlling malaria in the South Pacific, where U.S. soldiers were suffering from it, and even later work on Lyme disease. So this was, you know, a major project in medical history. Also characteristic of the time is that huge progress was being made in pathology, really beginning to understand how diseases worked. Birdseye, during his life, really never talked about any of this. The only thing he would say about his time in the Bitterroot is that he shot 770 wild animals in one season. Actually, he'd sometimes say he shot 1,000, which was his goal. But, you know, because it was government, they kept records, and I looked it up, and it was actually only 770. Still a lot of, you know, Rocky Mountain sheep and elk and bear and cougars and, you know, just all kinds of things. Collected over 4,000 ticks. Contributed a number of important ideas to the whole process.
My guest is author Mark Kurlansky. We're talking about his new book, Birdseye, The Adventures of a Curious Man. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Mark Kurlansky. His new book is called Bird's Eye, The Adventures of a Curious Man. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Mark, Bird's Eye's next adventure, he was invited to spend a few weeks on this medical missionary ship in Labrador. And I guess it's really not an exaggeration to say the trip would change the course of his life.
Yeah, absolutely. In ways that he didn't see for some time.
Mm-hmm.
Labrador was really the wilds. It was part of Newfoundland and Labrador, which was a separate British colony, not even part of Canada. And Labrador was the wild territory of it. Newfoundland was actually considered more settled. And it was frozen over for about 8 months a year. No ships could leave. No ships could come in. You couldn't get mail. You couldn't get supplies. There were no roads. The only means of transportation was dog sleds. And, you know, here's the thing that just kept amazing me about Bird's Eye. Well, so he decided to stay in Labrador, and so he started traveling hundreds of miles by dog sled. Now, I would think it would take some doing to learn how to manage a dog team and travel hundreds of miles by sled, but, you know, he just sort of picked it up. He worked on this hospital ship, and when the freeze came, they had to leave because they couldn't get into harbors anymore. And he decided to stay because he had met people, also typically Bird's Eye. He met people who were in the fur trade, and he grilled them intensely and learned everything he could and decided to become a fox fur trader. Newfoundland passed a law that you couldn't export furs anymore, and so he became a fox breeder so that he could export the live animals. And this also took a tremendous amount of knowledge to learn how to breed and keep wild animals.
And while he was there, he was always interested in the ways that the Inuit were able to survive.
Well, the thing about Bird's Eye is he was just interested in everything.
Mm-hmm.
And
it sounds like you.
People do say that. He saw a lot of Inuits because when the medical missionary left, the doctor who ran it left him in charge. So he was now sort of operating as a country doctor also, although, you know, he had no medical background. And he'd go see people who were sick and try to help them. And he really didn't reflect a lot on the ways of the Inuits. I mean, he sort of absorbed it, but it didn't affect his life until he got married. And he would, when the harbors thawed out, he would go back down to New York and to Washington, where he had met a woman when he was in the U.S. Biological Survey, who was the daughter of one of the founders of the National Geographic Society. So it was a woman who was used to these guys who just went off into the wilds and did crazy things. That's what her father did, and that's what her uncle did, and all the family friends. And so they got married and had a baby, and, you know, sure, I'll go up to Labrador with my newborn infant and live 200 miles by dog sled from the nearest medical facility. Not a problem. But Bird's Eye was kind of concerned at that point because nobody, including himself, ate fresh food. And they were also very unhealthy. It was a very unhealthy diet. And so he started thinking about how to supply fresh food. And that's when he started thinking about freezing and about the Inuits who would ice fish. And they would haul out the fish, and almost instantly it would freeze because it was like 40 degrees below zero. And when you thawed out the fish, it tasted pretty good. This was a startling thing because frozen food, which had been around since about the time of the Civil War, tasted terrible. It was frozen in huge quantities at about 30 degrees and 30 above zero, just below freezing. And, it would take a few days to freeze. And it would basically rot, and it'd be mushy and terrible. Nobody wanted to eat it. The state of New York banned the use of frozen food in the New York prison system. But this stuff in Labrador was pretty good. And he understood that the reason why was that it was frozen so quickly, which is a concept of crystallization that salt makers had known for centuries, that the faster crystals form, the smaller they are. So if you can freeze something really quickly, it'll be really small crystals and it won't disrupt the tissues that much. And he would buy lots of fresh food in the summertime, and he would pack it in snow. And they would live throughout the winter on this frozen food that was in barrels, and they'd take a hatchet and chop some off and thaw it out. Both he and his wife thought this food was remarkably good. So you would think that the next scene is they're back in New York trying to launch the frozen food industry.
We're two careers away from that.
He was just completely focused on his fur career, and then he gave up on that because of World War One, and in 1917 moved back to New York and Washington, and worked various jobs, and he ended up with a job in the U.S. Fisheries Association, which was a kind of a lobbying group for the fishing industry and tried to solve problems, and which was really Birdseye's thing. He loved solving problems. And the problem he worked on was how to get fish to market in a condition more like the condition it was in when you first took it out of the water.
Yeah, talk about what would happen and why Birdseye was really sort of disgusted by what would happen to fish over the course of a few days between being caught and being sold.
Yeah, well, sometimes they would try to put it in ice, but the ice would melt, so now it's sitting in water where, which is a great petri dish for bacteria to grow.
Yeah.
And it just really was not in very good condition in most places when you bought it. And he started experimenting with all kinds of packaging, fiberboard and various different kinds of packaging to try to bring the fish in better. And he thought if it was packed tight, it wouldn't lie around in all this water and bacteria couldn't grow. But it wasn't tremendously successful. He wasn't really very happy with his product either. And then he started thinking about Labrador. This is like 5-6 years later. And he hadn't thought about frozen food at all in that time, because in the United States, nobody was interested in frozen food. It's just nothing of any interest anywhere. And suddenly he started thinking, well, wouldn't this be some kind of a solution for the fisheries? And he always had this theory that ideas get planted in your brain and then they just pop out when you need them. I don't know about that, but in this case, that's what happened. And so he set up a company in New York and started freezing fish. And it went broke very quickly because nobody wanted frozen fish. Nobody wanted frozen anything.
Yeah, they cashed in their life insurance policy and sort of put everything they had into this.
Yeah, everything. Absolutely everything. And they now had two kids, and his amazing wife was just fine with this. She was absolutely convinced, maybe she was right, that her husband was just the greatest genius, and she had absolute faith in his ideas. And they sunk everything into this, and they moved to Gloucester, Massachusetts, which is the oldest fishing port in the U.S., and a place he knew of because his financial backer for his fur industry, a man named Harris Hammond, was from a wealthy family that lived in Gloucester. And in fact, a castle Harris's brother John built is still there. Actually, his brother was an inventor, also invented remote control. So you had, in old grubby Gloucester, you had famous inventors on both sides of the harbor. You had Hammond on one side and Birdseye on the other. And he set up this company that froze food. But he wasn't really trying to have a frozen food company because he had already learned that there was no market for frozen food. He had a much more ambitious idea to develop the frozen food industry. And to do that, this company would develop machinery and patent it, and then someday sell the patent to bigger people who had more money and the kind of money that could really develop an industry.
Which is exactly what happened.
It's exactly what happened, yeah. He developed all sorts of patents for packaging and for freezing food, and so that it would come out of a machine in a family-sized package, and developed all kinds of materials, got DuPont to invent cellophane wrappers, all kinds of things. And in 1929, he sold it to the Post Company, which was a food company that had C.W. Post, the founder, had died and left his daughter in control. And she and Hutton, the famous financier, were going around acquiring all kinds of food companies to try to build a food empire. And they bought Birdseye's company and patents and all assets for $23.5 million in 1929, a few months before the stock market crashed.
Yeah, it's amazing to think that if their boat had literally, if not docked when it did, we may never have heard of Clarence Birdseye.
Yeah, I think that if the deal had taken a few months longer and everybody had seen where the economy was going, the money wouldn't have been there to do the deal. The deal was done through Goldman Sachs, and they didn't know that the economy was about to tank. And it was a couple of years in the works.
Okay, well, we got to back up here for a second, Mark, because you've told us, and it makes sense, that Americans didn't like frozen food. It got mushy. It was slow frozen. There were these big ice crystals. It was thought of as far inferior to something that would, say, come out of a can or a jar. So talk a little bit about creating the market for these products and then about the impediment of making sure that every grocery store had a freezer to sell the stuff.
Yeah, that's why he needed all of this big Post money, because they really had to create an infrastructure out of nothing. I mean, there were no ways of transporting frozen food, no trucks or train cars or anything that you could transport them in. Stores didn't have any freezers, not to mention nobody wanted to buy the stuff. And they little by little worked on these problems, talking all these different sectors of the economy into it. They got stores to carry freezers by supplying them. They would put the freezer in and go there. Birdseye himself went to stores, and talked to housewives and, assured them that this frozen food tasted just like fresh food, which, today we think, well, hold on, frozen food doesn't taste just like fresh food. But that's because we're actually comparing it to fresh food. Mm-hmm. What they were doing was comparing it to canned food and salted food and the old kind of frozen food. And compared to those things, it tasted remarkably similar to fresh food. And so it was just a question of getting people to try it and also, developing the industry. So, you had to get household freezers. Nobody had freezers in their home either. So you had to develop all these things. And it really didn't get into full swing until after World War II. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just slowly built up.
I have to say I chuckled when I read that because he liked to think back on his youth and his adventures out in the West, Birdseye, as exotic as his tastes were, always really liked food that came in a can.
Yeah. His daughter-in-law told me that. He just always loved canned food, said it reminded him of being in Arizona.
So as people started to take this stuff, you mentioned earlier the fact that the packaging was a big deal. We take this so for granted now that there's plastic and there's waxed cardboard and there's all kinds of things that make perfect sense for putting frozen food in. But before Birdseye's time, essentially it was paper or nothing, right?
Paper or, well, not even paper so much. And it was wooden boxes. Mm. You know, that's what salted fish came in. Still does a lot. You know, those little wooden boxes that you get salt cod in.
Yeah.
And a lot of things came in wooden boxes.
Including Velveeta, which was also invented around this time.
Right, and cream cheese in the Northeast.
Hmm.
I remember as a kid, I always used to keep my toys in cream cheese boxes. But that didn't work very well for frozen food. So, you know, he was starting with nothing really and trying to come up with packaging. And a lot of his patents, he had over 300 patents. So he had like 200 inventions. And a number of them had to do with packaging.
Author Mark Kurlansky is my guest. We're talking this hour about his new book. It's called Birdseye, The Adventures of a Curious Man. Welcome back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us and ask a question, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Mark Kurlansky. His new book is called Birdseye, The Adventures of a Curious Man. Our email address is think@kera.org, and the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Birdseye also had an interest in dehydrated foods, and this was not as successful as his freezing of foods.
No, he thought it would be. He thought it would be a very similar story. And he had a similar idea, actually. He thought that if you dehydrated the food more quickly, it would be a better quality. But unlike frozen food, nobody else thought so. And this was right after World War II. And during World War II, a lot of soldiers were given dehydrated food. And they hated it. So dehydrated food had a very bad name, and it didn't go very far at all. But he had other successes. He formed a light bulb company in the 30s, and that was very successful. Eventually bought out by Sylvania. A number of innovative light bulbs, including something that we today call a parabolic aluminized reflector, those cone-shaped bulbs with a reflecting metallic back that are used in store windows and things, still very widely used. This was actually one of his most successful inventions.
So after he sold the company, the frozen foods company, and the patents, he essentially never stopped inventing.
No, invented a lot of things, some of which I don't think were ever made or ever used by anybody but him, like his whale harpoon, which I've seen. It's in the Peabody Essex Museum in Salem, Massachusetts, and it was interesting to look at because it really showed you where Birdseye was coming from as an inventor. It was such a completely mechanical thing that looked like he had put it together, probably did, from things that he picked up in hardware stores, and it was basically like a medieval crossbow with a hand crank and a big rubber band. He invented an automatic fishing reel. He was in the Gulf, and he was watching people fish, and he decided that he was always interested in processes and how to make processes better, and he thought, why do people fishermen waste so much time hauling the fish up after they get a strike? So he invented this thing where the fish hits the hook, and as soon as it hits the hook, you flip a switch, and it, the fish just rises straight up. I don't think anybody ever used this thing. So his last invention, which he developed in Peru for the Grace Company, was a process for turning sugar cane waste into paper, which was actually a very successful invention.
And they're still doing this today.
They are, yes.
Mm-hmm. We have an email here from Paul in Dallas who says, Birdseye sounds a lot like Ben Franklin, smart, curious, and inventive.
Well, yeah, I mean, a different time in a different context. But, yes, he was very much in the tradition of American inventors. American inventors are kind of unique in that they usually aren't real scientists and they aren't interested in theoretical science, and they're interested in problem solving and creating something of commercial value that you can then set up a company and make money from.
I was amused at how carefully he cultivated this image of himself. He didn't want people to think of him as an intellectual, but instead as an adventurer.
Yes, yeah, he very much pushed that idea. He loved the idea that he was an adventurer, and he loved to tell you about, you know, the Labrador and being out west, and he always kind of poo-pooed the idea that he was any kind of a scientist, and always pointed out that he didn't really have that much of an education. He loved photography. Even in Labrador, when photography was fairly new, I mean, one of the inventions of his childhood was the portable camera and the roll film.
Yeah.
So this was pretty new stuff. And, you know, all his life he had that interest in photography. And so when he was in Gloucester, he shot all these home movies. And his family had some of these films. I was looking at them. And, you know, they had a horse stable in West Gloucester, and they'd go riding. And there he'd be. Now, Clarence Birdseye was 5'7" and bald with glasses. And, you know, and always wear a suit and tie.
Mm-hmm.
But there he'd be on horseback, galloping away, firing a handgun on the bow of a boat, harpooning whales with his own harpoon.
Doesn't sound like a guy born in Brooklyn. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Well, talk about this. He also, he loved kids, but he was, I mean, what sort of parent was he?
Well, I think he was, he was definitely very much of a family man, devoted to his family. He had four kids, and he spent a lot of time with them, and he took a lot of interest in their friends and the kids in the neighborhood, and he was kind of a neat guy to know when you were a kid, because he was always doing weird things and he'd show them to you. How he, you know, would trap birds on his lawn and freeze them.
Yeah, he was that weird guy, but since he was wealthy, I guess parents would let their kids hang out over there.
That's right. Well, he was famous.
Yeah. So you include in the book, he wrote some fiction that actually got published, and you do not, in the book, you do not make a statement about whether it's any good, but I got the sense that maybe he was better served with his engineering and entrepreneurial career than with sticking with writing.
Well, I would say, completely off the record, of course,
yes,
that it's not the worst piece of fiction I've ever read, but it's certainly in the running. No, it was just terrible.
Did you learn anything about him as a human being by reading this?
Well, yeah, a couple of things. One is that he would try anything.
Yeah.
You know, he just had absolute confidence in his ability to do everything. And this was his only piece of fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And for the rest of his life, he used to, you know, he'd say, oh, people think of me as an inventor, but I'm more than an inventor. I'm a this and I'm a that. And one of the things he'd always list is I'm a writer because of this one terrible story that he did. But the story also, which is an adventure story in the Labrador, and it shows, of course, these were the kind of books he always read, too, but it shows how much he just really loved that whole notion of adventure.
Hmm. How did he and Eleanor end up in Peru at the end of his life?
He had an idea that there was already a process for turning sugarcane waste into paper.
Right.
And for some reason, I'm not really sure why, he was visiting a factory and he got this idea. He had this idea of how to do it more efficiently. And he took it to the Grace Company because they were doing things like that. And they offered him a job in Peru. And, you know, he said, well, I'll need this and that and that. And they gave him whatever he wanted to go down there and develop this process.
Now, he was told around that time that he had a heart condition. And the advice back then was really different from what it is today.
Yeah, that's right. He had a heart condition for quite some time and was told he had to be less active and should just kind of take it easy, stop riding horses and stop harpooning whales. He got rid of his boat and he got rid of his horses. And usually today, that's not the advice doctors give you.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, exercise and activity is good for people who have heart ailments. Except for exceptional cases. I mean, anybody out there with a heart ailment, don't take my word for this.
This is not medical advice from Mark Kurlinski.
Right. Actually, I have a brother who is a heart surgeon who I talked this over with. There was that notion. And, you know, a lot of people believe that he would have lived longer if he had stayed less active, but most doctors today don't agree with that at all.
Hmm. So American diets obviously changed. American kitchens changed. I mean, in some ways, Birdseye and his work came along at exactly the right moment in our history.
Yeah, yeah. Among other things, because women started joining the workforce in large numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a much greater need for comparatively instant food. The whole original idea of frozen food was it was a very expensive luxury product. But when it started catching on and Birdseye got competitors, they realized that to keep a good share of the market, you had to lower the price. And eventually, this became the food of working people, working women who, you know, weren't home all day preparing food, which after World War II was, you know, this was a huge shift in American society. and eventually all over the world. And frozen food just fit perfectly with that. And then I think what has really entrenched frozen food is something that Birdseye foresaw. He foresaw microwave. This means that there's no cooking time or thawing time at all. You know, you just take it out of the freezer and you zap it.
You just know he would have loved using a microwave.
Yeah, well, he talked about it, you know, that this was going to come and it was, you know, going to be a great thing. He always, in all of his interviews, he was just hyped up about all the great things industry was going to bring. He, you know, some of which came true and others didn't. He thought that New York City would become food self-sufficient and everybody would grow their own food hydroponically on their roofs.
It's funny that we're still talking about that today, but it still seems just as far out in the future.
Well, I'm sitting here in an apartment in New York City, and I'll tell you, I'm not farming hydroponically on the roof.
You got that phone in your hand that you can call for whatever you need.
That's right.
So he had one sister who started a candy company, another one who was a very well-educated nutritionist. Do we know anything about their culinary influences as kids that would have led them all to these sort of food-related careers?
No, I wish I did, because it's just very striking to have a family like this with a number of people who played important roles in food. I mean, one of his sisters was a really major nutritionist. And I could see from Birdseye, from his letters, that how much he loved food. I mean, he just always talked about food and wrote about food. And, you know, dear mom and dad, guess what I had for breakfast? he just was, he was food crazy. And apparently so were at least some of his siblings. I don't know if his parents were, but, you know, there must have been some reason why he was always writing to them about his food.
Yeah, there's one that you quote, and it's really funny. And he finishes his description and says, "Doesn't that just sound like the most delicious thing ever?"
Yeah.
Well, we have a lot for, as a working parent, I'm happy that frozen food exists, so I can thank Clarence Birdseye for that. And thank you, Mark Kurlansky, for being with us this hour. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, pleasure talking to you.
The new book by our author Mark Kurlansky is called Birdseye, The Adventures of a Curious Man. Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. We've got a free podcast available of the show. You can pick that up and check out schedules and other information about the program at kera.org/think. Think at kera.org is the email address. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.